struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, welcome to the show. I'm here today with Kieran Therakin. Kieran, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks, Travis. Thanks for having me on your show.
Hey, glad to have you. We're going to get into the details of the seven essential stories that charismatic leaders tell. But before we get into that, you work for an organization called Social Light. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. Well, I have a couple of different organizations I'm involved with. So the book itself that I wrote is with a company called Strategy Peak. That's just a firm of one. That's me. I'm a marketing strategy consultant. And then the Social Light company, we are a Shopify marketing agency. And we work with all sorts of companies in the direct-to-consumer space across the U.S., Canada, even in Europe as well. And we've also put up a brand new learning portal called Merchant Mastery. And that's a 50-hour program of video and coaching and group discussion. And that's really growing. We've got probably 1,800 merchants just in our Facebook group alone right now.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. I love that you're doing that. And it's so interesting to understand that all these different industries that are out there in the world, how they all apply to and interweave with the nonprofit world. So really excited to get drilled down and talk about those seven essential stories that charismatic leaders tell. Now, I know there's like this story branding framework out there that tells you kind of how to tell a story, but it doesn't really tell you what story to tell.
That's what I found before I wrote the book. You know, that's exactly the kind of research I ran into. There's lots of story framework type of books, but in the sense of how to go about and get your message out there. But I didn't see a lot on the actual story topics. And, you know, especially in some kind of a cohesive form with examples of how this was used throughout history to propel people movements.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I've been through the story branding framework. I've had a friend on, Jared Ledbetter, and we talked about what the story branding framework is. But really, that's just kind of like the hero's journey, kind of. And you're positioning yourself as the wise old sage, and you're helping your customer or your donor through that process so they can feel like the hero, which is not a bad way to do things. But it really doesn't exactly tell you what story to tell. So what's one of the stories of your seven that really needs to be showcased and highlighted?
And I've been involved with multiple not-for-profits over the years. In fact, I did a project a few years back with the United Way in town here. We ran an entire marketing program for the not-for-profits to get their message out. You know, this is the way you do it. So we know that not-for-profits, you know, they are in a continual, perpetual fundraising mode. That seems to be the primary business they're in. And secondary business is the value add that they were originally created for. And of course, that's not what they want to do. If they can actually reduce the amount of time they spend in development, then they have more time to spend in these other things. And the only way you can really do that is to identify your not-for-profit in the same kind of way as a for-profit business. And because it's the same principles, you know, you have to have a value proposition, you have to have a target market, you have to have an ability to a business model to deliver that value against competition, right? And in alignment with market and industry trends. So you have to have a business strategy mentality. And too many not-for-profit, and part of the problem with not-for-profits, I think, as well, is that almost anybody can incorporate a not-for-profit. You know, you just have to just go and say, I'm a not-for-profit, fill out the proper forms, and away you go. But the sea of competition out there, how do you stand out from it? And I was involved with a group here in Edmonton called 100 Men. And 100 Men, what we used to do is we get together once a month to hear from three not-for-profits. And each of the 100 men would then show up with $100. And at the end of the evening, one of the not-for-profit, and sometimes there's maybe 150 men there, and another 50 would mail it in, right? So one of those not-for-profits would walk away between with $15,000 to $20,000 that evening. I've seen it happen more than once. And everybody walked away with something. right? But this idea of having a brand and a vision, mission, things that you can actually infuse that donor's mind with that says, hey, you know what? I want to be part of that. That's something that I can get behind because the values are aligned and it's something that I can relate to. One of the clearest things that I learned, though, is no matter how good your not-for-profit was that evening and what it aspired to, never go up against the kids' profit, the children's not-for-profit, or the pets' not-for-profit. Dogs, cats, birds, yeah, always going to lose on those two things, right? And it doesn't matter what you're doing. Because people really have this embedded about the, especially the children's charities. Now that's always something that people want to go for. So if you're competing like that, how do you stand out? And the only way you can really do that is by telling stories that are relevant. So the easiest story out of the seven that is relevant is probably story number four. And story number four is all about the enemy we face, whatever the enemy we face is. And the enemy we face doesn't have to be a person. It can be something that is a challenge to overcome, right? Or something that we have to aspire to, but there's obstacles in the way. So obstacles, challenges, and it might be people as well. So you could fight against childhood poverty, or you can fight for adult literacy. And both those things involve an enemy or an obstacle or a challenge that we have to overcome. But then you have to wrap that around a story that tells why it's an obstacle, challenge, or the enemy, and what you can do to overcome it. And so that's story number four. And you can see that really good, really great not-for-profits do that well. The UN, for example, a few years ago, at the height of the Syrian crisis, it's very easy to say, hey, give to the UN, we will, UNICEF, in this case, it was UNICEF, which is part of the UN, give to our charitable fund, and we're going to make sure that money gets to who needs it in Syria. But instead, what they did was they told a story, and it was a very compelling story. And in fact, I can share that with you. I've got some slides around that to show you how they did it. But at the end of that, at the end of those, you know, four, five, eight frames, you had a very good idea of the depth of the crisis and why the resources were needed, how the resources were going to be deployed, and what was going to be done about it. You know, what would be accomplished at the end of it. And especially about if we didn't do this, you know, maybe things aren't going to be going as well as we would want them to as people, as humans, you know, helping other people out.
It's really interesting you bring that up. I know Reagan, in one of his famous speeches leading up to his first presidency, he talked about the war on welfare and welfare abuses. And he told all these facts and all these standards, like this is happening. But it wasn't really till he put a face on the problem, he could identify, you know, who the enemy was. He talked about the queen of welfare fraud and the four different identities she used to earn $150,000 a year tax-free and was able to, you know, operate in this fact. You know, saying that there's 100,000 people that are doing, you know, X, Y, and Z, it has no impact. But sharing a story about a specific individual that you can kind of put a name and a face to. And I'm not saying, you know, what I'm not saying is putting up a picture and be like, this person is the reason. That's not what I'm talking about. But creating that story that can identify and put that face on the problem is what really helps solidify all the things that you're talking about and trying to accomplish.
Yeah. Ultimately, your brand, and it doesn't matter if you're a for-profit or not-for-profit, your brand revolves around meaning embedded in the story. And the meaning of a specific outcome, a tangible, concrete outcome, which is the value proposition, but then embedded in story form. And it's not just even one story. There's multiple stories in an overall story complex that you use to embed that narrative and that meaning and that deep sense of purpose and the value propositions that you want people to think about. Now, Reagan notwithstanding, you know, narratives can be used for good and evil at the same time, right? And depending on how powerful the narrative is, it can lead people one way or the other. And so we have to be very, very deliberate about the narratives that we create, because not everybody is a welfare queen. You know, absolutely not. So a lot of people were caught in that snare. of that story, right? Yeah. And there was a lot of angst that resulted, and people deprived of legitimate resources through the welfare system as a result of this political strategy of that welfare queen. And you can go on and on like that. You and I are probably of a similar age. You know, you can talk about Willie Horton, you know, and that was during the Dukakis and Bush era, right? And I think Willie Horton was paroled or something like that by Dukakis when he was a governor. But it just shows you the power of a narrative to sway elections, let alone contributions to a not-for-profit.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I grew up in the 80s. I grew up on those social programs, including welfare, because just the nature of, you know, living with a parent with mental illness. But you see this a lot in politics, and I'm not going to get political, but you can hear when certain individuals talk about and they refer to their opponent or a situation, and they're drumming up things from World War II, Hitler, fascism, whatever, right? They're trying to get that feeling and assign that other person as a bad guy. So it's a negative way to use these kind of stories to brand someone as the enemy. And anyone that brings up something like World War II in their speeches nowadays, in my opinion, they just have no value or actual context of anything relative to the 21st century. Yeah. Yeah. It's 80 years ago. If that's the story that you're building off of to try to paint the picture of this person, do you have anything more relevant, or are you just trying to make people angry?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And in fact, you know, ultimately narratives have to evoke an emotion, you know, in order for them to be compelling. So my theory is simply that emotions are the catalyst, your value propositions are the bridge, and the emotions that you feel after you receive that value proposition in concrete form are the destination. So you start with something because you feel a lack or a need to do something, and then you end up in a state of, you know, possessing something concrete, tangible, or even a mental state that provides emotional relief and sanctuary. Of some kind. You feel, that you've accomplished something, that you were able to contribute, or simply that, you know, you were able to place something into the environment that is going to benefit everybody. But ultimately, all those things deliver an emotional benefit to you.
Oh, absolutely. And in the nonprofit world, it's not like the for-profit world, right? That I know I say this a lot in my episodes. So if you're a longtime listener, bear with me. You know, you give me $5 or whatever, I give you this pen, direct, very concrete. When you're in the nonprofit world, you are spinning this story and making sure that you can draw the potential donor into the story to understand that there's a problem, here's what it is, that you have the solution, and this donor can't solve this thing on their own, that they have to contribute as part of the whole to help combat whatever this thing is, this crisis is, and then you bring them into the story so they can be part of the solution. And unless you can bring them into the story, you haven't made, quote unquote, the sale.
Right. And a customer is the same thing as a donor. You know, they have to buy into something. And the very first thing that a customer buys into, your donor buys into, is the narrative. If they don't buy into the story, they won't buy into anything else. So the very first thing that anybody buys is your story. And there's the story plex there. There's multiple stories that help the customer's mind, your donor's mind, gel around what's going on, what's needed, what's the outcome? How can I play a role in this process?
Oh, absolutely. One of the other really interesting things between the for-profit world and the nonprofit world is you're looking for a specific type of customer in both cases. Where it gets kind of fuzzy and kind of gray, especially when you talk about veteran organizations, is when you are out looking for, someone to buy a pen. You know, you have a whole wide variety of people that are interested in buying pens, and you talk to all sorts of different people. In the veteran nonprofit world, they're trying to sell this solution to veterans, but they only seem to talk to veterans in order to raise money and gain support. You wouldn't go into the homeless community to try to raise funds to help the homeless, but somehow people in the veteran world forget that the veterans are really the recipients and not the primary donors to their cause.
we're all in the storytelling business. You know, that is the very first. In fact, the only way we can communicate with each other is by telling stories. We're telling stories to each other right now. No, facts by themselves, until they're embedded with meaning, have no real ability to embed themselves permanently in someone's mind. So we are storytellers, or we at least need to master storytelling in order to master communication. And the whole purpose of communication is response. So if you're not getting the right response, you have not communicated well. And the reason you're not communicating well is usually two things: wrong channels, wrong markets, or wrong stories. That's three things, actually, right? So, three things. So it's either you have the wrong story through the wrong channel to the wrong target market. One of those three things, and maybe all three of those things, are going to be a problem. So, for example, you know, you would never, it's exactly what you're saying, you know, you would never, if you're a movie producer, movie house like MGM or whoever it is, right? DreamWorks. You have to be very cognizant about who you're writing the script for to begin with. Is this a children's audience, or, you know, that's the animation side, or is it something bigger than that? You know, in the way of a science fiction audience or some kind of a comedy audience. Well, those are three different scripts. And based on those three different scripts, you have three different ways you can go about telling that story. And then when you market it, you have to choose the channels that that audience is going to be a part of. And you certainly wouldn't market an adult type of film, you know, in the sense of a mature film, right? Not an adult film. It's a mature film.
This is a family show, Kieran.
Yeah, it's a family show. Right? It is a family show. You wouldn't market that, you know, through children's channels. You just wouldn't do it. You would want to go hyper specific and be able to find out exactly where, and if it's a science fiction movie, you want to target those science fiction channels. And, you know, those are very clearly defined. And if you don't hit it, that's really your fault, not anybody else's.
You know, when we're talking about this, we're talking about advertising to children. I remember, you know, when I became an adult and you start changing the things that you watch on TV. And it wasn't until I had kids, because you kind of just like there's no like serial commercials on the channels that I was watching. And I was like, do these still, you know, things still happen? And then you have kids and you start watching their channels again, and you're like, oh, here's where the toy commercials and the cereal commercials are. Because me as an adult without children, no one was trying to market those things to me because they knew that they wouldn't find me, right? That their customer is not who I was at the time. Just the reason you won't find a Lamborghini commercial on TV, because most of our customers don't spend a lot of time watching TV, right? They're not wasting their marketing dollars on that particular channel because their customer's not there.
Yeah, such a hyper-specific market as well for exotic cars that you want to be hyper-specific in your channels as well. I'll tell you an interesting thing. So at Socialite, we are in the business of advertising for our Shopify merchants. And we never advertise a single ad or ad set. We actually test multiple ad sets all the time. And almost all ads go through various types of defined cycles, you know? So very few of them are unicorn ads, but you are absolutely searching for them all the time. Some are don't even get off the ground. Okay. And then the other ones start climbing up and peter out. And other ones, you know, stay steady eddy for a long time. You have no clue what those ads are going to be until you test them. You know, until you test, you just don't know. And in fact, what was working, you know, last month may be petering out or it may be gaining. So you got to be monitoring. The ultimate thing about an ad is a message. How you are testing that message against the following things. Yeah, the headline of the message, the subtitle of the message, the image of the message, and then the message's angle. Those are the four basic things you're testing. Then you're testing it against audiences to see what will resonate with a specific audience. And so ultimately, you know, there's no greater proof than to see the click-through rates and the ultimate, you know, cash register ring to see the sales occur. And then you are so clear that if you put a dollar in here, you're going to get $4 out on the back end of that funnel. You know, and so that's the kind of thing you are trying to test. And what are you testing? You're testing a story. That's all an ad is. Ad is a little mini story. And it has a promise of something. If you click through, you're going to find a landing page on the other side that's going to fulfill what the promise of this little mini story is all about. And what I find, especially with not-for-profits, and certainly a lot of for-profit businesses, is that they do not test their messages and their resulting stories that they that they're offering to their client base, their customer base.
Yeah, I definitely see that through all the interviews I've done. I don't know, hundreds of groups that I've talked to, most of them, as far as I can tell, are just flying by the seat of their pants. They're begging for money, begging for volunteers, whoever they get, they try to get them in the machine and get them working. They don't do a lot of things intentionally. Now, if you are listening to this and you're a nonprofit and you're doing things intentionally, let me know, because I don't even know who you are. Send me an email, nonprofitarchitect@gmail.com, so I can start talking about your story instead of all the other people I end up talking to. But intentionality, it's like they don't have time to do anything. Like, their hair is always on fire. You mentioned at the top of the show, perpetually fundraising. That seems like their mission, instead of the impact they're trying to provide, is actually just raising money. And so many times they're doing this alone. They're not engaging their team. They're not being leaders. Either they don't know how to, or they don't feel like they have time to. And you have to be able to use the stories to get the right people on board. Now, almost every nonprofit I'm talking to, they end up talking about their origin story sometime during whatever presentation. What do you think are the key elements of an origin story?
Well, ultimately, the origin story, in fact, that is story number one in the book, Creation and Origin. And ultimately, it is about the people involved and the inciting incident. There's usually an inciting incident. So what is the catalyst that created the deep angst or the opportunity or the need for this organization to come together? And that can be as simple as even a product for an organization. So what precipitated the idea of this new product? So there's an origin story. I've written a blog post about the origin story of the 3M Post-it note. And you know, it all had to do with church hymnals. That's why the inventor invented it. And now it is a worldwide multi-billion dollar phenomenon, right? For the 3M company. But what is the origin story? So each one of these organizations has some kind of an inciting incident to begin with. I was the VP of an organization, not-for-profit in town many years ago, 20, 25 years ago. It's morphed into something bigger now. But at that time, what they did is they provided emergency overnight shelter for children in need. So these are usually teenagers. They've been kicked out of the house, whatever's going on. And then this, in fact, the place was called the Youth Emergency Shelter. That's what it was called. Such a clear brand, such a clear purpose. But then over the course of the next 10, 15, 20 years, the mission morphed and it grew and it developed tentacles and it kept going down the value chain. And now they are perpetually raising, not for the original fund, which is just some beds in a safe place, to now they've got all sorts of big programs to get these kids back on their feet and, you know, all these kind of things. But the funding model may not have kept up with it. Okay, so that shelter society has long since morphed into other things. But there's an example of what we call strategic drift. And, you know, and it's scope creep, strategic drift. You can call it a lot of different things. But now you're forced to raise all this money for something that the place wasn't even originally created for. You know, and it creates a lot of angst and that perpetual fundraising model that no one wants to be in.
You would think that's not a true statement based on how many organizations are in a perpetual fundraising model. You would almost think that they desire that instead of creating the income streams and the recurring revenue they need to get the job done.
Well, you know, let's be a little blunt here. So, this is a show, I'm a guest, and we're going to create some excitement. When I left the shelter, I ran into a board member about a year and a half later. And he was a little disappointed with the current executive director that we had and such. And of course, the shelter was very much in the storytelling mode. You know, they always got the stories out there. And the story that's coming out now is that we are in a crisis and we will need to, raise more funds. We want to be able to, you know, meet these needs of these children in this process, all this kind of stuff. And he was really concerned. And this is a fairly new board member. he was pretty concerned that this is just doom, gloom, and that's what it is. And I look at him and I say, well, Larry, you're not going to get a lot of fundraising done if you say, hey, everything's good. Everything's fine. No problems. You know, all that kind of stuff. And so you are in a perpetual negative cycle for this particular charity, for in the narratives that you're spinning. But and then you are in that perpetual development cycle as well for the business model that has extended itself well beyond what its original purpose was. So the deliberateness of creating a business that lasts is never something that I see strategic purpose around. You know, because the business model seems to be, let's go raise more funds this year. We got to continue to fund these programs we got.
It's so interesting. In Upstream by Dan Heath, he talks about the origin story of the book. You're walking your dog and you see a kid in the river screaming for help, and you jump in and you save the kid. And by the time you get back to shore, you're out of breath, you're soaking wet, and then you hear another kid screaming. And Nick goes through this a couple, two, three, four times. And eventually you're like, how are these kids falling in the river? The interesting thing about most nonprofits, and I can't say all, I can say a good portion of, you know, they're in the business of saving as opposed to being in the business of preventing. And how easy is it to raise money for all these people that we've helped this time instead of raising money for, this is how many people we've prevented from entering our program because they haven't, you know, come upon this crisis, and because of the counseling and the preventative work that we do, less people actually need our services.
Okay. So, you know, we're coming up on, and that's a very interesting thing, because one of the questions is who gets the headlines? And so we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, right? We're coming up on the 20th anniversary of that. Now, two jets were flown into the towers on that day. And if somebody had gotten the wind, you know, let's say a year earlier, saying, you know, this is a problem. These cockpit doors are a problem. They are subject to hijack. And we need to reinforce that, make sure that no one can enter that cockpit. We would never have had an incident like that, a terrorist incident like that. But there wouldn't be any story either. There would be, no one would get credit for the prescience, for that advanced knowledge and strategy, saying we need to reinforce all these things so we don't have an incident. But Rudy Giuliani got to walk around the rubble and was the hero of the next, you know, a week and a half, 10 days, whatever it was, because he was bringing the city together to deal with this big tragedy. So prevention gets a very small amount of headline credit, if at all. And everything is all about the rescue. And the saving and all that kind of stuff. That's where all the glamour is. And we need to be able to change those narratives, you know, to be able to value that prevention and that getting people out of that problem, and especially not allowing them to get into the problem to begin with. There's a much bigger opportunity on a human basis to be had to prevent heroin addiction, OxyContin addiction, than it is to get people off the drug.
Yeah, isn't that, it's interesting the way that our society works. If you look at news organizations in general, you have the Walter Cronkites of the era that come out and they report the news. And then you have like the gossip columnists that talk about whatever nonsense is happening between people. But because of the way that we're driven and the way that we're designed, one obviously makes more money than the other one. So much, in fact, that it changed the way that we report the quote unquote news, and are no longer really reporting the news. We're reporting a portion of the news and then spending the next hour telling us how we're supposed to feel about the thing that they reported outside of the context when it was created. So it's such a hard thing to do to actually solve the problem, because solving the problem, you don't really get any credit for it. So you're trying to figure out, how do you address this thing, continue getting the funds in, and people, you know, cry and whine and bellyache about, you know, how much fundraising happens. Well, if you're going to affect millions of lives, you need to raise millions of dollars. That's just how it is. That's just how it is. You got to pay the best people to come in and have the best impact. And if you're going to save millions of people, it's going to cost millions of dollars. It's the same way in business. You want to, you know, if your marketing budget is $300, how far are you going to get? you're not going to be able to make the sales you want to keep your company going. You're going to have to spend some real ad dollars in order to reach the people you want to reach. I mean, Coca-Cola, the biggest beverage brand in the world, still spends millions upon millions of dollars every quarter making sure that they're still the biggest brand out there.
Yeah. And the example I use, you know, what's more clear than a lottery? You know, when it comes to the value proposition, buy a $5 ticket, win, you know, $50 million. You know, that's such a clear value proposition. But if I go outside on the freeways right now, there's the billboard advertising the lottery for the Saturday. Why do they do that? Because you still need to get the word out, the message out, the story out as to what's possible.
You know, and just on a personal note, I'm not a lottery fan. I think it's kind of a tax on the poor and people that don't know what they're doing with their money. But if it gets over $400 million, even though my chances go down, I put a $20 in the pot just because you never know.
Me too. It's got to get to a certain amount of money before I'm excited about it. But, you know, $50 million. Here's a way to do it.
Yeah. I actually won the Mega Millions. I like matched like three numbers. So I won $200. But it was up at like $800 million or higher. And I posted on my Facebook that I won. And they're like, oh, my God, what are you going to buy? Well, it was only $200. So I didn't win the jackpot. But, you know, getting into your book, you can actually create your own jackpot because you're learning which stories you need to tell. Tell us about the Mighty Wins story. What is that all about?
So the Mighty Wins, what I say is that every organization, for-profit, not-for-profit, is like a sailing ship. And sailing ships need wind to power the boat sails. So the problem is most people go out and they build the boat, which is your business model. Okay, they build the boat without ascertaining the direction, availability, or strength of the wind. And so you're building all sorts of different styles of boats. You can build a schooner, you can build a tanker, maybe it's a sail tanker, right? You need to be able to build a boat for the available wind. And then point your ship, that sailboat, in the direction that the wind will power you in. Now, the winds, what we're talking about here, are macro trends. And so the macro trends are things like societal trends, technological, economic, environmental trends, political, and legislative. Those are the six big macro trends, and they affect your markets, your industries, and your competition. Everybody's affected by this. And so if you're on the right side of that macro trend, then you are going to take full advantage of this wind and be able to take full advantage of this tailwind. And you're going to go twice as fast, three times as fast, because you are not fighting the wind. You're not heading into that direction. So here's a clear thing that's affected not-for-profits in the last 15 years, for sure, if not the last 20. And that is simply the availability of direct money transfers, let alone taking credit cards, let alone whatever it is. And, you know, for all we know, there may be a trend that you have to start taking crypto. Start taking cryptocurrency. That's entirely possible. So to stay on top of these kinds of things, you know, is a very, very important part. And that's a technological trend. That is a technological trend. But, you know, if we take a look at societal trends, demographically, your audience is in a constant state of motion. You know, your donor base is in a constant state of motion. So the donors that were, giving to you 10 years ago, they're 10 years older now. Their values are either more solid or they are changing. And there's a group of new people that have funds now that can contribute to it. Those are distinct audiences. You can't market to a 25-year-old donor the same way you can market to a 45-year-old donor. It doesn't work.
What? Are you sure? I only put out one flyer. Isn't everyone supposed to jump on board with my one flyer that I write?
Shockingly enough, it's not going to work as well for you as if you segment your audience and the messages that you send to it. And so these kinds of things, you know, what you're trying to do, you know, is build that asset base in your audience. In your donor base, it's an asset base. It's a perpetual asset base if you do it properly, and that is going to give to you because they believe in your cause and your vision and your mission. We have to be able to do that in a way that is consistent with where the market is going demographically, rather than where it is today. So, where it is today, absolutely important. What's the 5-year plan, though? You know, I was in the mergers and acquisitions business years ago. with a large accounting firm, international accounting firm, and we were selling companies on behalf of their owners. Now, the average owner is that is looking to sell their business is not 25 years old. Okay, and the average owner starts thinking about selling their business when they're 55. And they may not exit the business for another 5-10 years. So our market cycle time for getting the word out there is actually a 5-10 year cycle time. And yes, there are companies that are being sold right today. Absolutely correct. But what you also want to do is till the field for that 3-5-10 year cycle ahead of time as well. Because not everybody says, hey, I'm going to sell my business now. Just like not everybody says, hey, I'm going to leave you as part of my estate. You know, I'm going to put you in the in my will for my insurance proceeds to fund your not-for-profit. They don't do that instantly. That is something that you have to build a brand in their minds over years of time so that you build that relevance so that they can make those kind of decisions in those estate plans. And my question to you is, how are you doing that now? Are you doing that now? Or is your hand just out saying, hi, want to donate?
You know, it's interesting. They have those donors that have given that are you know, changing, you know, their age, obviously every time I give, they're a little bit older, a little bit older, a little bit older. And then they forget to thank people for 3 to 6 months, or they think that COVID means no one's giving, or they create this thing in their mind, they accept it without questioning it. And then they go and do or don't do based on the thing that they've come up with in their head. If you're cultivating these long-term relationships and you get to someone, you're like, hey, let's talk estate planning. What do you want your legacy to look like? And then the next year they're still around and be like, hey, instead of being this in your legacy planning, what would it be like to give this giant gift now so you can actually see the impact this great gift has while you're still alive? Like, how do you change that conversation? It's very interesting. And the people that are doing this well are the people that have a staff, that have paid positions, that have this plan in place, and they're actually executing. The chief executing officer, right? The chief executive is executing these things with a team. Where you're not seeing this is in startups, people that don't learn about their nonprofit work, people that aren't building teams, and people that aren't collecting a paycheck.
Yeah. You have to be, you know, ultimately, the word is you have to be professional about this. And part of that professionalism is that you employ a strategic plan. You have specific methods and tactics, you know, to cultivate your donor base and to make sure they're engaged. You don't take any volunteer that shows up for your event. They have to be trained. You know, you would never just hire any employee that showed up. You want to interview them and you want to, right? See,
but so many people don't do that. They are struggling for volunteers. So they take anyone that walks in and out of the street, whether they're fit for their organization or not. I wanted to hop back a little bit because you talked about the different ways that people can give money. You know, back in the day, it was give me a check or give me cash. Now it's, can you wire transfer? Do you have the Cash App? Do you use Venmo? Do you use Apple or Google Pay? Do you use cryptocurrency? And for those of you listening that haven't heard it yet, go back and listen to my episode with Joel Cleland. And he talks about, or no, Joel Cleland, whatever the pronunciation is. Sorry, Joel. He talks about what cryptocurrency is. He gives you the background on it and then different ways you can accept that and either hold a crypto or convert it to cash instantly to have that value you want to have now. If here's the deal, if by the end of next year, if you're not accepting crypto in your nonprofit, you're missing out on thousands and or millions of dollars worth of donations. But you have to be up with the times. You can't have all these roadblocks for people to give. If they want to give with using Ember Pay and you don't accept Ember Pay, you just lost them for a lifetime. They'll never come back and look at you again. I'm loving this discussion, Kieran. I love these stories that we tell. What I don't understand is why people don't end up telling these stories or they don't put any thought into it. What do you find that are roadblocks for people to really create these things and get them out with their messaging and out to the world?
They don't have a plan. It's as simple as that. They do not have a plan. They don't have a method. They don't have a process. They don't have a culture that values these kinds of things. There's constant reactive mode based on things that always worked, right? And they stopped working sooner or later. I'll give you an example from my not-for-profit experience as well. The idea of planning and not just doing what you did last year. That seems to be the plan for a lot of people. So at the shelter that I was involved in, and again, that's morphed into something different now. So I'm not telling any tales out of school. So this is 20, 25 years ago as well. Every year they used to have like a daffodil and daisy lunch. And it would be a group of well-heeled society women. All right. And I'm exaggerating a little. We're Edmonton up here in Canada. And they'd come together and they'd have a nice lunch and they'd donate money to the shelter. And great supporters of the organization and such. And everybody had a good time at the thing. When I got there, and this has been going on for years by the time I got there. And as a board member, I'm looking at this and I'm asking the development people, how much money does it cost, you know, and to actually produce this? And I'm not even talking money. I'm talking about your staff time inclusive, you know, not only and we're taking a look at the ticket prices, what we raise in development dollars, all this kind of stuff. After I add all of this up, my God, we're not making any money. We're probably losing money. Maybe it's a good branding event, but you know, where's that? Why are we doing this? And no one had taken the time to assess this from an economics point of view. So one of the first things, and I eventually rose to the high rank of VP of the organization, and they were threatening to make me president, which is why I quit. But I did come back again a few years later to help the new executive director out. But as a VP there, one of the things I was doing was these development activities. So we absolutely put the kibosh on the daffodil dinner or whatever it was called at that time. And instead, we launched this other thing called Homeless for a Night. So myself and the development manager, I think she became the president at that point in time of the organization, the executive director. We came up with this idea, right? Why don't we do this thing? Why don't we do Homeless for a Night? First of all, it's completely on brand with the emergency shelter. And so we got the local baseball stadium to donate their field. And we pitched a bunch of tents. But, you know, unlike homeless people, there's tents, there's live entertainment, no alcohol, but a lot of people coming together to experience what it's like to be homeless for the night. And then there's a pancake breakfast the next day. We raised a few hundred thousand dollars every one of those events. Now, eventually that petered out as well. Right? Everything has a lifespan, but we're now measuring these kind of things with economics. So the big difference between the daffodil lunch and homeless for a night is one is completely on brand and it makes money. That's the story that we're telling. And because the story is resonant, that's how we're able to generate some positive cash flow.
It's interesting that you actually dissect this. So many people don't. When I look at the organizations that I like to work with, I do think you should have an annual kind of event. The big difference for me is I want to make sure that event is a fundraiser and not a fundraiser. I believe, and I teach, that all of your funds should be raised on a monthly recurring basis. So when you put this type of event together, you're not worrying about it being your income source. If your income is not already sourced, then I think you're just really desperate and grasping at straws. Now, if this is your premier event and you raise a whole lot of money from this thing, and you normally do, that's fine. But I want fundraisers to turn into friendraisers where you're showcasing what you're doing and your strengths and your successes and not begging for nickels and dimes. Not a fan of that at all.
But you know, but there's a whole aspect of marketing and branding donor based development where they become a friend base, right? Rather than just an asset base. One of the things that I was very pleased to see here in town was the local food bank offered a monthly donation. So it comes straight off the credit card and away you go. So instead of doing an annual drive or, you know, and they do that with big events that we have, bring a can of food, whatever it is, right? I can just go there and put my credit card in and then they'll take X number of dollars off the credit card every month, right? And I liked doing that. I think I need to do that, right? I think I want to do that. And I did do that. I haven't heard from the food bank ever. And I'm one of their donors, right? I've never heard from the food bank. Now, to me, that doesn't mean I'm going to stop donating. I'm just saying, my God, what's going on here? I'm a customer. Like, I'm not a client of yours, but, you know, I'm a donor. That makes me your customer, right? And so I'm one of the inputs. Take care of me, at least in the following way. Tell me what's going on. Tell me the impact that I'm making. Show me what else I can do, right? But no one has reached out to me to do that. But I'll continue to donate on my credit card. That's not an issue. But what more could happen if there was that engagement? That's the question.
Oh, absolutely. If you're interested in the stats on this thing specifically, check out my interview with Brady Josephson from Next After. He talks that only 12% of organizations right now actually thank their donors for every donation.
Or engage their donors, things like that. There's a lot of ways to engage that donor base. You know, I'd love to know how I could get involved with the organization. I have not heard boo from them. And they have my details. I know they have my details because they keep charging my credit card.
They've got the most important detail for them. And here's the deal. If you're an organization right now and you're chasing dollars, you're dollars focused instead of people focused, you're going to close up shop. That's just how it works. The relationships wane off and they fizzle. And then pretty soon you're chasing dollars only. You're forgetting about the people. And then you're no longer having an organization. That's how it works. And Kieran, I'm loving all this. Where can people find you and your book?
Well, if you come to strategypeak.com, that's my marketing consulting site. On the right-hand column, you'll see a little download place for a couple of chapters of the book. And you can find the book on Amazon. So you go to Amazon, look for The 7 Essential Stories Charismatic Leaders Tell, and it'll give you a framework for not only building culture in your organization, and that's the operating system of your organization, then how to infuse that operating system with the 7 essential stories so that the whole place comes alive. So that's on Amazon. But I'll tell you what, Travis, for the first 5 of your listeners that tell me and email me, and I'll send you my email address for the show notes. If they email me and tell me that they heard me on your show, the first 5, I'm going to send them a free Kindle copy of the book.
Oh, that's amazing, Kieran. We really appreciate that. You hear that? First 5 people to actually email Kieran and say that you heard it on the Nonprofit Architect Podcast, you get a free download, so might as well take it. Hey, Kieran, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for being my guest today and providing endless value.
Travis, thanks for having me on the show.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.